Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women. I'm joined by digital media director Jess Geary. Jess is a self-confessed digital evangelist. She studied English language and literature at the University of Birmingham and whilst there co-wrote a weekly lifestyle blog with Alex Beard for Redbrick, a student publication that is both printed and published online, written by students for the students. Saying goodbye to Redbrick when she graduated, she continued to write her own blog for a number of years whilst also working as a copywriter for articles and social posts. She landed a job as a digital display executive at Total Media, a behavioural planning agency that focuses on the content required and where it is best placed to reach the audience. She then went on to work at a number of agencies, Decoded, GroupM, Hyper Island, before landing her current role at Wrap, a global advertising agency, where she uses her talents as a digital media specialist, curating and determining which platform is best suited for content. Jess is also the founder of Margos, an online tool that helps build confidence and grounding. In 2015, she was diagnosed with hyperempathy, a disorder where you can't distinguish someone else's emotions from your own. She set out on a course of self-healing, quietness and looking within, and she discovered tools and techniques that really made a difference to her well-being. She was compelled to share with others what had helped her shift away from the idea of success being measured by things such as likes or through external validation from others, to a state of internal happiness and joy, and as a result, Margos was born. The site allows you to decide what's right for you in that moment, a day of self-work or a day of the world around me. You're able to access guides to building self-worth, from breathing exercises to tools for assessing things that impact on your state of mind and interactions with others. It's a beautiful site that feels calm as soon as you land on the homepage, and it is evident that both the concept and execution has been crafted with kindness and compassion. Jess, it is such a delight to welcome you to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Cool. So I wonder if we can start first off talking about your role as a digital media director. Can you explain to me what that is?
Yes. So it actually probably might be worth explaining what digital media is first.
Sure.
And then how one can direct it.
Okay.
So digital media refers to anything kind of online where you can put and buy media or consume media. Mm-hmm. So that means display, which is a kind of term used in advertising for all of those banners that follow you around the internet. So say you looked at a toaster on John Lewis last week and then it's everywhere, it's in your fridge, it's on your sofa, it's consistently around you.
Yeah.
That's display. Programmatic is the technology which fuels that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got video, video on demand, all of those videos that you watch and those ads that you watch before Gogglebox or Coronation Street or something. And then you've got mobile video as well. Mobile is a whole different channel in itself, but still falls into digital media. And then you've got social channels as well. So those are the main areas that I actually specialise in. Uh-huh. But then on top of that, you've got PPC, paid search, and also SEO. So that is digital media as a world. And my job is to work with the strategists and creatives to figure out which channel will be best suited to what piece of content, because all of those channels are so different.
Yeah.
And they all have such unique behavioural and psychological meaning attached to them. A video on a cinema ad, completely different to an Instagram ad. So my job is to kind of unpick the strategy and say, this would be perfect for mobile because X, Y, and Z. What
that is so helpful. That has completely opened up. I mean, I had an idea, and of course I work with in creative, but yeah, just breaking it down that way is just, yeah. So you must have to really deep dive into all those different opportunities and possibilities.
Yeah.
So how do you acquire that knowledge? How have you kind of found where you should put something? And then how do you then go through that process to understand that?
That's such an interesting question. And it's one of those things, I've been working in it for so long, I actually don't really know anymore.
Yeah.
But I guess it's just you learn, you read so much around it. There's so much literature out there about different types of channels for not only different people, but different content, different countries, for instance. So it's all about finding out the kind of crux of the brief. Mm-hmm. So the objectives, where does it need to go? Who does it need to go out to? Mm-hmm. And then you'll find that there is a natural fit for a channel. Well, one will stand out more than the other. Mm. And sometimes as well, it's just experience. Mm. So sometimes it's about knowing the very basics that a brand campaign needs something bigger, like video, to sustain it, compared to a direct response campaign. So buying, making people buy, is something completely different. That might be mobile, or it might be just straight online website ads. So it depends on that, really. And I think there is some foundational techniques that you learn when you're a lot younger in the industry that you will use forever. And it's just building on top of those.
So can I ask you how you arrived to your kind of point now in your career? What was the journey to becoming a digital media director?
Yeah, oh, it's a long one. So I actually think one of the most interesting things is how I started, because then the rest of it kind of becomes a sort of very similar story. But, unlike other kids, I guess, I've always wanted to do this. And it's such a... I still find this absolutely baffling now. I've always wanted to work in advertising. Always. And, I think when I was, like, 12 or something, I wanted to be a vet for maybe 2 weeks, as all 12-year-old girls do. But
saving the puppies.
Saving the puppies, I just love the puppies. I don't want any of the responsibility. But I've always wanted to do it. I remember watching What Women Want with Mel Gibson and Helen Hunt. Helen Hunt, by the way, is the hardest name as a northerner to say. Helen Hunt. Helen Hunt. And she played an advertising exec called Darcy in that. I just remember watching it and being fascinated that people were paid to create little worlds in 30-second TVCs. These little sort of impactful, meaningful little worlds. And that must have been when I was about 14-ish. So I started just ripping out advertising in press, because I was just reading lots of, like, you know, girly magazines back then, just terrible things now. I think, God, how damaging, thank God. I got rid of all of them. Just, like, ripping out loads of different, like, hair adverts, jeans adverts, and started having a look at them. I've got them all saved.
That's amazing.
Still, and it's bananas to look at. I just was really interested in strap lines and wording, and I've always been bookish, always been very sort of literature focused as well. And as you mentioned, did a degree in literature in the end. So I just love the words, and I thought I would become a copywriter. So smash cut to a couple of years down the line, and I got my first internship at McCann Manchester when I was 15.
Just
young.
That's amazing.
So young.
That's great, though, that they open the door to you and let you come in.
Absolutely. I think it's your year 10 work experience. Okay. But it went on and on and on. I didn't stop. I just loved it because I've been wanting to do it for so long. And it was like a 9-minute drive from my house in Macclesfield. So it was perfect.
It must have been feeling so grown up as well. At 15, going into an agency.
I feel so grown up. I actually feel like more childish now. 100%. More like, oh God, what's happening? But it was it's such a gorgeous agency, and still is. Does all the Aldi work, actually. A fantastic agency. So I loved it. And as soon as I stepped into agency land, it was everything I think I thought that I wanted it to be. It was like a big adult creche where all of your weird ideas and thoughts were rewarded, and you were given sort of a budget to be able to do it, and all that kind of stuff. So I loved it. And I did actually that until I was 21. And just in summers and any breaks at uni, I would just go and I would work there. If I couldn't work there, I would use my blog before influencers were a thing. if only I'd have kept it on, I would have been a billionaire. And I just did that, and that just kind of racked up that body of work with them until it was my third year of uni, and then I got my first job there, first permanent role there, which was incredible. So worked there for about another year, which doesn't seem like long, but I was working there for, that would have been my, fifth year, something like
that.
It's a long time. And just absolutely loved it, but sort of new pastures were waiting in media. Oh, it's probably worth mentioning as well that I didn't realise that media was a job when I was in McCann's, because they were pretty much pure play creative, but they did have a media unit. I didn't work in that. But when I was a lot younger, the creative directors there gave me a little task. And looking back now, I'm like, that was very sweet of them, because they're very busy. Very busy people, bless them. Yeah. And they gave me a little task to do, and I remember it so distinctly. It was for Scholl, for some insoles, which were sort of odorita sort of insoles. And he gave me, Marcus Hadfield, gave me a big book, and I was obsessed with this book, and it was just a book full of advertising, and what it was the DNAD manual at the time. Just collecting dust.
Yeah.
I was just flicking through it, and I found that advertising for the first time wasn't just print. Uh-huh. I just thought it was print because I've for so long I've just been ripping out these magazine inserts. But it could be anything. So he sent me off on this little sort of expedition to go and create an ad for Scholl, just like a fake one.
Yeah.
So I came back and I created a kind of cardboard box coffin. I've always been a bit morbid.
Yeah.
So this was perfect for me. So a little cardboard box coffin in that looked like a shoebox.
Uh-huh.
And the strap line that I created in my lovely 15-year-old head was like, kill photo to dead, which is very basic, but they were all bits of ambient advertising that you could have around.
Yeah.
So I got really interested in format and medium from that, which is kind of why I was interested in media. It's not so much about the creative, it's about where you place it, it's context. So that kind of made me think about that. Moved down to London, moved to Total Media.
Yeah.
Absolute baptism of fire of what media was. Because that was back in the day where young people especially took on a media role because it's the easiest job you could do drunk, hungover and sober and the output wouldn't change. Yeah. It's the exact same output. You could do it in any one of those states and be okay. And it was, I can't really tell you too much about those years. I can't massively remember them, if I'm honest, but that was 22 to 24, and just an incredible agency. Got, you know, a huge amount from that, but they really trained me on pure play planning and buying strategies off that. Mm. So from that springboard, I just did the rounds, really, in terms of the media agencies where I went after that. Decoded and Hyper Island were actually very slightly different punctuations in my career because they focus on data and hacking and coding and hardware and education.
Uh-huh.
The huge thing that I'm passionate about is education. Uh-huh. So the kind of two strands, I guess, from Total Media onwards were to work in digital and to really upskill myself digitally, learn how to code, learn all about these, you know, absolutely bananas hacking things and that kind of world, really dip my toe in that, and also how to teach and educate.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of culminated in my role at Wrap, where it was very digital, very technically focused, but also I knew that it was a creative agency, so would have to have some of that education piece as well. So Wrap really is that kind of perfect combination, I think, for me.
So you worked really hard from 15 whilst you were at uni and going and doing your summers there. It must have been so formative as well, like just to kind of watch and observe and then get involved. And how awesome that they, you know, were like, go off and do this and gave you time to do that. Like, I have a huge respect for people that do that.
Same. And it's just like, just the most amount of gratitude for people taking their time out for kids, really. Kids that just are very enthusiastic about everything and, you know, don't ask for permission. They just speak up and say stuff. Like, that could have very easily been shut down and had ended my career in advertising, but instead they gave me a voice and a platform to just be the most weird person in the room ever. And they never said, don't be.
Yeah.
They just said, okay, well, because a client once bought one of the ideas, one of the weirder ideas that I came up with, which resulted in 100 carrier pigeons having to be trained to fly from Normandy to Trafalgar Square.
And that sounds awesome.
Which was great.
Yeah.
But I think when I was definitely a bit younger, that was a bit like, okay, that's a bit far. But apart from that, to get to that place, no one ever stopped me. And that's, I owe everyone a huge debt, really, to that, for where I am now. It takes a village, as you probably know as well, to get you there. So
I'm wondering if you can tell me, like, on a day-to-day basis, what is a typical day for you? Is there a typical day? What kind of happens?
Yeah, so actually there is a typical day, but it depends on the brief cycle. So we as media people and also strategists live and die by the brief. So brief cycles are normally around 2 weeks in length. So there are typical days on that cycle. There's workshopping right through to implementation. But you can have 5 or 6 of those cycles going at once.
Mm-hmm.
So you can be on different ends of that.
Yeah.
Most of the brief cycles are very similar. we all get together, do a brainstorm about what we feel it looks like, where that strategy is going. And when I say we, it's the media team, the strategists and the creatives all together.
Right.
It's a powerful group of people.
Yeah.
There's nothing that they can't do or solve together.
Yeah.
It's great because, you know, everyone's brains are engaged and working towards something. It's so gorgeous to watch. And then we take it back and we take all of that creative joy and squeeze it out of everything and put everything into meticulous plans, but making sure that the creatives are happy and the strategists are happy with where we want to place. Once everything's okay with that, and the client has said, yeah, that's great. So we normally get a huge amount of budget.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great job if you like shopping,
mm-hmm.
Because you still get the same high.
Yeah.
You just don't have to spend any of your own money. But, I mean, the budgets are, you know, wonderful, huge amounts of money to work with. Once they're happy with that, they sign it off. And then the creatives go and create.
Mm-hmm.
We say, you know, two vertical videos, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
And then the strategists kind of step away from the role, and then that's where our role begins. So we then tag and traffic that creative that comes back, and that's basically just a tiny bit snippet of code in there, making sure that it can be measured and the success of it can be measured properly and thoroughly. Very important part.
Mm-hmm.
Oh god, it's one of the most important bits actually, and should always be talked about a briefing. And then we negotiate with the suppliers and then send it out into the world. So then we wait for about a week.
Yeah.
So we have a week's respite.
Yeah.
And if we're not working on other briefs, that's actually a lovely week. We can do bits of admin, lots of finance, quite a finance heavy job as well. And then we start getting the results in. Now this is the exciting bit.
Yeah, definitely.
This is the bit. Are you a data person as
well? I love data.
Yes.
I love stats.
Yes.
Yeah.
Same. Oh, it makes me so joyful.
Yeah, yeah.
It really does. So then you start holding your plan accountable, the creative accountable.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone will always blame the creative. It is, I would like to say this on behalf of creatives, it's not always the creative at all. And there's a whole spectrum of things, why things don't work, why things do work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that bit to me is just the best bit.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless if it goes well or not, that's actually not hugely important to me.
Mm-hmm.
It obviously is. Obviously, want everything to go well,
yeah.
But it's finding out. It's being more interpretive and finding out what's actually going on in this data, and building a picture. So that's pretty much it. That's a typical cycle, but you can be on any one of those every day.
Yeah. Okay. So if something isn't going well, so you start getting data back, is it a case of then looking at the creative strategy and then reorientating? Is that what happens? So there's kind of, and if it's going well, like great, and then maybe tweaking it to make it fly even more. Does that process happen?
That's it, yeah. So there is this, we call it a dynamic testing culture, which is a very agency way of putting it. But it's basically just a team of optimizers who just basically get in kind of lockdown mode and they start testing and learning about what's going right and what's going wrong. So it'll normally be, it could either be the creative or the messaging. More likely than not, it could just be, you know, that it's a new ad, for instance, and we have to give it a little longer. But yeah, absolutely, that is the process. And it's as important to do it when things are going well than it is to do when things are going badly. So there is a constant evolution of not resting on your laurels, trying new stuff out. And if nothing can go disastrously wrong, really, especially with online, because you can just switch the tags off. It's beautiful. But if you run a terrible ad on them, and we've all seen them, my ad fails are honestly just terrifying for a planner, but also hilarious. We've all seen when that goes wrong, it's hard to stop that press, that print run.
Yeah.
It's not too difficult to swap out an ad, which is misspelt or, you know, not doing particularly well.
Uh-huh.
So it's a really great, flexible role in that instance, yeah.
And did you say there's a role called optimizers? I have never heard that
before.
So the optimizer takes the data and, as obviously, as you've just explained, that's their role.
That's their role. So yeah, or you'll hear them more typically as ad ops. So ad operations, but they are the people.
Mm-hmm.
They are like an incredible sort of crack team of data miners, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And they look at the data, sift through the whole thing and start spotting patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I used to do, and I just love it. And I'm much more strategic now, but they tend to just really sit in that all day.
Yeah.
And there's something secure to me about that. And there's something so lovely. And again, it's one of those jobs you can do very well hungover.
A theme's emerging here.
I mean, yes. It's a media... Yeah, I would like to point out that I don't drink that much anymore. But yeah, so I, yeah, that is, it's a great role to do. And incredibly, everyone in a media team is as important as the other person. So me as a director, it actually means nothing compared to assistants, execs, everyone else in between. You know, it doesn't make a difference, really.
So you've mentioned you work with creatives, you work with strategists, you work with optimizers. Who else do you work with? Is that basically, is that the core group?
That is the core squad. But sometimes data science, marketing sciences, and this is that I just find them fascinating as well. So this is when normally we get sort of data science involved when there are certain segmentations that we want to go for, or no segmentation at all, and we want to speak to people on a more individual level. So RAP's actually fantastically positioned to do this because they... individuality is where we thrive at RAP because we can talk to people on a one-to-one basis. Not all agencies can do that. So we work a lot with them. This is probably my sort of first role that I've ever been so heavily involved with data science, but they are an absolute ball to be with and just have incredible insights which help, you know, give us the proof that we need to help clients succeed and go, you know, skyrocket, really. So that's pretty much it.
And do you have a lot of direct contact with the clients? Are you working and discussing with them, kind of bit of client liaison?
Oh yeah, all the time. All the time. So in constant contact, whether that's in email form or weekly calls. I try and meet as many of them as possible because a lot of this energy sort of comes across a bit better probably. But there is, there's a lot of client contact, which I really love, and and client leadership as well. So it's about, you know, helping your clients and educating them on the innovative stuff, the fun stuff for them. Marketing is a tiny part of their huge roles every day. And I like to think that it's one of the most fun bits, really. So let's make it fun for them.
So your roles really vary, kind of reach where you're kind of dipping in and dipping out. And this kind of, I mean, you've also got the overview of everything as well, of a campaign as such.
I mean, it depends on how big your team is. So our kind of height of sort of largeness, I guess. We were only six even still. So it depends, you kind of have to be a bit of everything. Bigger agencies, you don't. You can just specialise. But I would highly recommend having a lot of tools in your arsenal to be able to pull on, because I found that very valuable in my career myself.
So what skills do you need to be an effective digital media director?
The skill of translation, of being a translator, is 100% a big one, which is to say you are translating the technical limitations and restrictions and also abilities of what this piece of media is able to do to creatives who just want to play and just want to make and create and just, you know, and we work with amazing young creatives as well that just want to run with the piece. So it's translating that and making it important and also understandable. And then equally the creatives to the tech people saying, you know, we can't just squash everything down into a mid-page unit or something. So there is a bit of a go-between role there. Having a lot of patience. Things don't happen overnight. And also you'll be explaining a lot, different concepts, over and over and over again. Even in one meeting, in one sitting, you'll be talking about the same thing. And just having a genuine excitement and interest and enthusiasm for the craft of the job. Is the biggest skill, and that is a skill because you do have to work on it, because there are times when you think, God, this is absolutely pointless. Why am I here? When you're on your 17th, you know, tab of your spreadsheet, and you're like, God. But if you have that like dogged enthusiasm and sort of positive outlook on the fact that you are creating and doing something, quite creative in itself, then you'll be fine. But that's it, really. The technical abilities, no one should be worried about that or scared of that. They're super, super easy, very specific to the role. So you always learn them from the beginning. But it does help if you do like a bit of digital, sort of you have a bit of a nerdy side, or you're interested in coding or something, it's always going to be beneficial.
So I'm wondering if we can talk about your other project, Margot's. What is it? How did it come about? And how does it function?
So Margot's is a wellbeing organisation that I founded in 2016. And it's nearly 3 years old at the end of April, which has flown by. And so it came about after I was diagnosed in early 2015, as you mentioned, with hyper-empathy and depression, actually, as a result of compound trauma, which is a series of big T and small T traumas which happen in a very arbitrary amount of time, it's 6 months or less. What was happening at the time was that my brain couldn't actually function properly to deal with any one of them, so it dealt with none of them and actually completely disassociated. And in that, parts of my sort of cognitive functions, such as linguistic ability to process trauma, things like that, and my egoic brain had started to shut down slightly. So I got taken off for some testing and came back with a diagnosis for borderline personality disorder, and part of that is hyperempathy. So not being able to tell the difference between your emotions and my emotions. If you said to me that you were having a bad day, I wouldn't understand that that was you and not me, so I would start to have a bad day too. It was a real nightmare in London, especially.
And tough.
So tough.
Yeah.
So tough.
We're all emotional, whether we're holding it back or... And if you're tapping into other people's kind of energy and moods, that must have been so tough.
It was tough because it is like you said, exactly as you said, it's the unspoken and the spoken.
Yeah.
So it's the energy field that people were giving off. I became very, very good at knowing when people were about to cry, about an hour before they were going to do it, which was a superpower. Banana superpower. And it just to have that ability was so interesting for me as a learner and as someone that is interested in pretty much everything. Something I knew something fascinating was going on with me. So Margot's was born from about a year of avid reading about empathy, what I was going through, but borderline personality, and also just my brain and the cognition and humans and how we all work and think, and what my sort of what this new honed in ability was allowing me to do that was positive. I knew it had to be positive. If I got too caught up in it, I would be even more anxious and everything. So I moved back home for a bit. London's a difficult place to have HE. There's so many people, I think, as well. And sort of, yeah, it was born from this want, I guess, when I was starting my sort of healing path, if you like, to help other people really feel their emotions, not be scared of them, learn how to control them, which is something that I had to learn to do, and just be at peace with them. And then through that, it's become so zeitgeisty, I guess. I hate to say it, but it has. Yeah. And but it's been really interesting for me as someone that it doesn't really shout too much about the business, but just does a lot of work, I guess, behind the scenes on it, to see that rise of well-being and, you know, well-being trademark, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's basically, it was born to, originally as talks. So our first talk was called Empathy is the New Black. And it's about talks about getting people to talk about their emotions more. But then what I found more valuable when I was going through my process of self-healing was to be on my own doing it. So Margot's now exists as a space where people can find her and learn the skills of calm and confidence. We only have two moods on Margot's, and that's everything's very, very purposeful. And all those moods are split into the self, if you want to do self work, or others. So if you need to relate to someone else in a confident way or a calm way, we give you the tools and techniques to empower you and equip you to be able to interpret that yourself. It's not directional, it's not shouty or prescriptive, it's suggestions and just thought starters that were born from a lot of that literature that I consumed over that 2 year period.
It's amazing. And I have to say, like hearing you talk just then, it's so... admiration is the wrong word because it sounds so trite, but, you know, to look at where you're at, look at your diagnosis, and to be going through a difficult time and then think, how can this be positive, is such an awesome way to self-heal, you know, rather than dig down into whatever's going on, to be able to lift your head up. So that's awesome. And,
you know,
like I kind of said in the intro, the website is so beautiful. You feel so calm on it and going through it and the toolkit, and I just loved it. I wasn't aware actually there was talk, so but
oh, thank you so much for saying that.
No, that's
very
great.
Means a lot. And we did kind of just start out as the talks, really, and that was up in Manchester, and because it was first Margot's Manchester was the entire name of it. That kind of, you know, hopefully is reflected, and thank you so much for saying that, is reflected in the way that we kind of try and come across now. And the toolkit's just a word on those. I've been downloaded so many times now. I only get to speak about it very occasionally, so this is great. So the fact that people are finding it still is amazing. They, just in case anyone wants to download them, are just two toolkits, one on self-confidence, one on self-worth. Mm-hmm. And they are just pocket guides, so you can download them directly to your phone, and they're all free, they will always be free. And they're just 5 pages or 6 pages of tools and techniques and suggestions if you have a moment of self-doubt and you know, a shake in your self-compassion, then they're kind of go-to things that you can have.
They are awesome. And what I love, and I was going to touch on this as well, is that your website is free. And what I love is there's loads of stuff out there, and there's loads of apps and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, not just seeing them, they're great, but there's always then, well, there's, you get to a certain point and then it's gated and then you have to pay. And I just was like, oh, what a beautiful thing to just offer it out into the world, and that people can just tap into it when they need it. And like you said, it's definitely not preachy. It's definitely not telling you what to do. All these lovely suggestions, just stuff to ruminate over and think about, is so lovely.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I do sometimes struggle with some of the paid for sites and things like that. But I mean, Margot's will always be that. Mm-hmm. And I like to think that I would probably be in a good position if I wanted to, with the digital media knowledge that I have, be like, right, we're going to make it a success.
It's going global.
And I'm going to be on Forbes. Yeah. And I go, well, you know, and it's... I have a quiet ambition for Margot, so it'll just help when it needs to be. We actually do no advertising. I say we, I always use the royal we. Mm-hmm. I don't have a media budget for it. Mm-hmm. And there is a reason for that. Margot's exists as hopefully just a place where if you find it, then great. I hope you stay and I hope you enjoy it. And that's it, really. You know, there is no ongoing need to check back all the time. There is not a lot of content that we do on purpose. But when we do it, we try and talk about it a lot.
And if people want to go to the website?
Yes, and if you do, which I suggest that you do, it's margosclub.com.
Awesome. Yep. So can you talk about the relationship between Margot's and your role as a kind of digital media director? Is there crossover? You've kind of talked about not having a budget for digital media for Margot's, but do they inform each other in any way?
Sometimes, absolutely, yeah. There is more of a call for a business like Margot's or a collective or an organisation like Margot's in the workplace than there has ever been before. Mm-hmm. I get more corporate emails asking what we do, who we are as Margot's, everything, these days than I have ever got before. So sometimes there is a real need for it in something like advertising, where it's all go, all the time. You know, you're pitching consistently, there's late nights, early starts, no one says thank you, stressful environment to work in. So there is a need for it out there. So that's only where it really crosses over. I'm just sold out on some intuitive leadership workshops through Margot's in March time. And they basically exist to teach these skills of empathy, compassion, and courage in the workplace and how to do that as a leader when you get to a senior position. So that in that aspect, they cross over, But I think purposefully, I've kept my skill set very, very separate away from Margot's and just focused in on the making it a nice experience once you get there, instead of pulling thousands of people there. If I ever do want to say, you know, let's absolutely go for it, I'm sure that would be totally fine, but it just doesn't feel quite right yet.
Is there a next step or chapter for Margot's, or it's something, like you said, it's there for the moment and it's something you may develop later?
It's definitely just there for the moment. There is, like I said, there's the workshops, but they actually sit outside of that. There's the workshops, there's more toolkits, there's always more toolkits in development, and that's pretty much it in terms of Margot's next steps. But I am doing a main stage talk at Omni Women, which is our kind of big conference every year about Margot's mental health and vulnerability.
Oh, that's awesome. I can't wait. Oh, that's going to be amazing.
I can't wait. What's more vulnerable than being in front of all of your colleagues talking about mental health? Yeah. So, I mean, again, just another great example of message meeting medium, a running theme in my life. But, so that, I guess, is the next step for it. And I'm sure off the back of that, that there will be some opportunities there. But, for the time being, it's kind of just existing in there for when people need it.
Great. So Can we talk about your creativity? Because your job's really creative, running Margos is really creative. So where do you go to fuel your creativity? What do you do, kind of what do you tap into?
So Ali actually said this on her episode. So Ali Waring, who I work with, in this episode.
Who suggested you to come on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I love her to pieces. She said the taste as well, and it would be silly of me not to mention it, because we work on the South Bank, just behind the Tate Modern, and there is something so secure in the four corners of an Excel cell, and so wonderful and safe there that you need shaking out, and nothing does that quite like art. And I love art, and I love performances, where I get a ton of inspiration from anyone performing, particularly things like comedy, because when I was in my sort of, I couldn't watch any news when I was hyper empathetic, so just watched a ton of comedy, loads of SNL, like I just couldn't stop watching comedy, so I find that really inspirational, and very creative linguistically as well. For me, it's very exciting. Lots of dances and any sort of theatre and things like that I find incredible. I'm not actually artistic as a person, maybe more of a creative thinker, but I can't sing and I can't act and draw or anything like that.
So Jess, you can write. I've read your blogs.
Thank you.
And your use of language and it's fun and light and highly intelligent. Is creative.
Thank you. It's just, I think I channel a lot into that, and reading obviously as well, which I think I keep bringing it back to. Reading, doing bits of writing. My friends are all incredibly creative. I have an incredibly inspirational sister as well, who obviously got me into the world of advertising and is just a fantastic creative force in my life as well. So yeah, a ton of things. I'm one of those people, I think, that just gets like excited by life sometimes.
I can see
not all the things, not all the time. Sometimes I wake up and think, oh God, I look like a toe. But you know, most things, when you are looking for the magic in everything, you can find it. And that's, I can apply that directly to the job as well. You know, data in and of itself isn't interesting. You find the interest in it. And I find the same stuff with life and creativity. So that's kind of what builds up a bit of an inspirational kind of vision for me, I guess.
What has been one of the biggest challenges in your career?
My biggest challenge, I think, in my career is just, it's never been people saying no. I think the only bad thing anyone's, you know, sort of ever said to me is that I'm too ambitious. And I think that was it, which obviously it's like a red rag to a bull, which just makes you like crazy ambitious then. So I think having that mindset of constantly having to prove to myself that I am good and worthy and supposed to be here was actually probably the biggest challenge that I faced, because it blocks you from enjoying it, from being open to opportunity, because your perception so narrow. It's my biggest fear is narrow perception. And it just widens entirely as soon as you let go of the expectation of yourself to be and do your best every single day. You can just aim for it, but it doesn't mean you have to, you know, be that standard all the time. So I think that's been the biggest learning and unlearning that I've had, I think.
Yeah, that is tough. I definitely have had that as well.
Have you?
You put huge pressure on yourself.
Huge.
And I caught up with Helena Gaunt the other day. She's the principal of the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama.
Wow.
And we were talking about that sometimes you put so much pressure on you and you focus on the end point that actually the journey you're not even enjoying. You're just putting huge, and it blocks creativity, opportunity.
Absolutely. And it's all in your head and your perception of stuff. No one else thinks. Everyone thinks you're amazing and great and like you're doing it and people are envious of you. But if you're not happy or comfortable, maybe is a better word, then it just doesn't mean as much when you get that next thing. You don't enjoy the thing because you're on to the next.
And don't even appreciate the success of what you've achieved.
Exactly.
It's almost forgotten because you're like pushing yourself onto that next
thing. And isn't that the hardest thing?
Yeah.
Sometimes I think the hardest emotion that I can feel is pride. I do. I sometimes really struggle to, 'cause people will objectively be like, that was good.
Yeah.
Your intro, great example. I heard that and I was like, sounds quite impressive. sounds pretty good.
It's super impressive because
you
are.
But you know, when it's, you really do have to train your mindset to be like, no, this is good and you're doing really well. And, you know, it's all that self-talk, positive self-talk. You know, if you're not enjoying that journey, there's absolutely no point in doing it, because most of it's journey. That's what no one tells you. Most of it is the journey there, and then you get the thing and then it's the next bit, you know, so you may as well enjoy it.
Could you tell me what advice you'd give someone wanting to be a digital media director?
Yes, of course. So this is going to sound trite, but I 100% mean this, because I feel like when we get in the industry, or we're trying to get in the industry, everyone tells the same sort of advice of, you know, work hard, be enthusiastic, lean in, drag your chair up to the table and stuff. But once you're there, my honest to God biggest piece of advice is have something interesting to say when the tech fails. Mm-hmm. So three things are guaranteed in life: death, taxes, and that the tech is going to fail in a meeting. 100%. Yeah. Something's going to happen. And the biggest impact people can make is in that 20-minute window. So average tech fails for 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And in that 20 minutes, you can either be flapping around with the rest of them, trying in HMIs and VGAs and all that kind of stuff, or you can be the ringmaster of that situation and have something interesting to say, have something fun to say, talk to the clients, have that opportunity to talk to the clients about something different, and be the person that they remember as someone that held that situation together, and not only did it with, you know, grace and charm and charisma, but also just gave them something interesting to talk about and think about whilst everyone else can flap around. So that would genuinely be my piece of advice, because it always happens. So it sounds a bit flippant to have something good to say.
Not at all. I think being the ringmaster is the best advice ever.
Yes. It's just, having that control. You have control over that situation and use that time wisely.
What have you got coming up? We're coming to the end of the interview. So what have you got in the kind of next few weeks or months?
So March is going to be a huge month. Huge month. So as I mentioned, I've got Omni Women coming up, which is going to be great. And then on that same week, I'm starting my lecture series at the IDM School, which is teaching compelling and persuasive communication on their data-driven marketing course. And it's the first time that I've ever done any, like, lecturing. Because I do a lot of talks and workshops and things, but this is the first time it's ever been formalised.
That's super exciting.
So exciting. Yeah. And I'm trying not to be scared. I'm trying to be brave. Yeah. But that'll be great as well. So I'm just writing all the content for that at the moment. So I think those are my two big things that are coming up.
Well, they're pretty big.
They're pretty
big.
They're pretty big. I'm going to make a slight move, actually, career-wise. Mm-hmm. It's still within RAP, but into the content team. So it'll be more to do with sort of whilst the content is being created and just before the content's being created by our amazing content team, about thinking about strategically where we're going to place all of that stuff. Okay. So that's it, really.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, that's quite a lot.
It's quite a lot, yeah. I need a nap.
Sadly, we're coming to the end. So before you go, I'm wondering if you can tell me about if there's a career or job in the creative industries you know little about, and I ask everyone this, so potentially I could get that role on the podcast, and also someone else you would recommend or suggest that I get in contact and hopefully get on, greater than
11%. Yes, I have a massive blind spot when it comes to production. And it's my big thing, I think, that I love producers, my best friend's a producer, and I would love to hear more about what they do day to day and how it fits in the sort of ad sphere. And as for a powerful, amazing woman that's who isn't a producer, I would love to hear from Mary Keane Dawson, who is the CEO of Truth Agency, a blockchain media agency using cryptocurrency technology to power their media buys. So having that element of it, using something new and innovative, she is just incredible. And I've been on panels with her where I've just been asked a question directly after her, but I've just been staring at her, being like blown away by what she's saying. So she has some amazing innovative ideas, and she is just an absolute tour de force. So I would love to
Great.
Yeah.
I'd definitely try.
You would get on very well with her. Yeah.
I can't tell you how much I've loved speaking to you, and I'm just, you know, thank you for being so open and honest. Kind of about your journey, and I'm really inspired as well. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you too.
Thank you for listening.
If you enjoyed, please write a review on Apple Podcasts, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. And also stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases. This podcast is made possible by the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haberson, and to Mary Continenza for designing the beautiful artwork.